Good morning. My name is David Dean, attorney registration number 28912, appearing on behalf of plaintiff appellant Don Haynes, whom I will refer to as appellant this morning. May it please opposing counsel, those in attendance, and the honorable members of this division of the Colorado Court of Appeals. Before giving a brief statement of the case and addressing appellant's substantive arguments, I would like to highlight the issues which appellant believes to be determinative of this appeal. First is the absolute right of a client to terminate the attorney-client relationship at any time, and the concomitant duty of the courts to respect that decision and to not continue the attorney-client relationship in any way. Second, and what is really a subpart of the prior point, is the legal effect to be given Rule 121, Section 1-1, specifically whether a rule of local practice and civil procedure can abrogate or modify the substantive right, here the right of the client to terminate the attorney-client relationship as recognized by adjudicated cases. Third is the requirement under Rule 25 that a decedent's successors and personal representatives be personally served with the notice of death, and the fact that a court entering judgment in the absence of said personal service lacks the authority as well as the jurisdiction to so enter judgment. Finally is the fact that trial counsel below did in fact argue excusable neglect. Where the court has read the briefs and is aware of the factual record, I would like to briefly highlight the facts that appellant thinks are important on this appeal. In May of 2008, appellant filed suit for injury sustained in a motor vehicle accident. In October of 2008, appellant fired her former trial counsel, Mr. Paul Hoffman. Mr. Hoffman communicated this fact to counsel for appellee in a letter dated October 26, 2008. In November of 2008, appellee passed away. On December 5, 2008, counsel for appellee filed a notice of death and purported to serve the same upon Mr. Paul Hoffman. In May of 2009, appellee filed a motion to dismiss pursuant to Rule 25. 5 days later, trial counsel for appellant filed a motion to substitute personal representative. Thereafter, in December of 2009, the trial court granted appellee's motion to dismiss for failure to timely substitute the personal representative. Appellant submits that this appeal is about one thing: the recognition of the fundamental notion that a client can terminate and sever the attorney-client relationship at any time and for any reason, and whether the courts of this state will give binding legal effect to that decision by the client. The right of the client to terminate the attorney-client relationship is well recognized and is not in dispute in this matter. What appears to be in dispute is the legal effect to be given that decision by the client, namely, whether courts will recognize that a discharged attorney cannot thereafter bind the former client in any way or accept service on behalf of that client.
Mr. Dean, doesn't the client have some duty to notify everyone else, including the court, that she has terminated the relationship?
I believe that the rules of professional conduct in Rule 121 place the majority of that burden upon counsel. And in this instance, Mr. Hoffman did in fact inform counsel for appellee within a month of being discharged that he had in fact been discharged by the client.
Now, as I understand it, what was not the notice of death served by CourtLink?
Yes, it was e-filed, Your Honor.
So we've established a system for how documents are to be filed. The defendant in this case filed the document in accordance with the court system, and there's a problem here. Now, is that the court's problem or the defendant's problem, or is that the plaintiff's problem?
Well, I don't know whose problem it is, but I think the better course of action, had I been counsel for appellee and I knew that opposing counsel had been discharged by the client but remained the attorney of record for purposes of LexisNexis and e-filing, would have been to serve opposing counsel, as was done in this case, as well as have personal service affected upon the client. Because I believe that counsel for appellee, having actual knowledge that Mr. Hoffman had been discharged, could not rely upon service upon Mr. Hoffman. Counsel for appellee does not know whether Mr. Hoffman's going to pass along this notice to a client who has fired him.
Mr. Dean, how do you reconcile your position with the Pearson case, which says we are not concerned about actual representation, but we're concerned whether it's attorney of record?
Sure. And, you know, I think that the Pearson case is distinguishable on a number of issues. First of all, in Pearson, there was no evidence that the client had ever discharged or terminated the services of the attorney. The court in Pearson spoke at length about the fact that the client in Pearson, the mother of the children, had purposefully fled the state and was trying to avoid the jurisdiction of the state of Colorado. In addition, subsequent to the portion of the discussion you mentioned in Pearson, the court goes on to note that one basis for finding that notice was sufficient to Ms. Pearson in the Pearson case was the fact that the orders previously entered by the court in Pearson were interlocutory in nature, and there was not a final judgment. So the court in Pearson, in finding that notice was sufficient, really hung its hat on a few different items. But one thing that was lacking in Pearson that is present here is that Rule 25 specifically requires service, and if the in accordance with Rule 5. And if the party is represented by counsel, that service is to be upon counsel. Pearson, they did not discuss this, but it was that case was not in the context of a specific rule requiring service. The court in Pearson, their discussion focused on whether Ms. Pearson had notice. And that is not what Rule 25 and Rule 5 require in this instance.
Mr. Dean, I just have a question. On May of 2009, the defendant filed a motion to dismiss, and I'm trying to figure out who's directing counsel. It's not, counsel is not representing the estate or represent personal representative or trying to sort that out.
That is correct. I mean, you know, on a practical level, the party directing counsel for appellee is the insurance carrier. As far as the legal authority to file the motion to dismiss, I believe that in Farmers as well as Garcia, it's been recognized that counsel for a decedent not only has the duty to notify the court to file the notice of death, but also has the authority to institute a motion to dismiss. Here, it is not in dispute that appellant discharged her attorney in October of 2008. If the courts are to give legal effect to that decision by the client, the purported service on the discharged attorney cannot be deemed proper. As appellant understands the position of appellee, the foregoing is valid and dispositive, save the application of Rule 121. In turning to Rule 121, appellee argues and the trial court found that Rule 121, Section 1-1, results in a discharged attorney retaining their status as an attorney for the former client until a court grants a Rule 121 motion to withdraw. This argument and finding by the trial court are incorrect for two reasons. First, under well-settled law, Rule 121, as a rule of local practice and civil procedure, is concerned with the efficient administration of justice, is not intended to and cannot abrogate or modify the substantive rights of the parties. Appellant is aware of no authority to the contrary. Second, and contrary to appellee's assertions on appeal, not all of the cases relied upon by appellant predate the adoption of Rule 121. Rule 121 was adopted in 1988. The Olson case, the 1995 Colorado Supreme Court case. The Berry case was decided in 1989 by the United States District Court for the District of Colorado and specifically addressed an attorney's duties under Rule 121. Finally, in the event that this division does not find the previously discussed authority to be dispositive of this matter, an opinion by another division of this court provides another basis for appellant's requested relief. Sawyer, the decision in Sawyer brought Colorado into conformity with the majority of federal courts by requiring personal service of the notice of death upon a decedent's successors or personal representatives for the 90-day clock of Rule 25 to begin running. I would like to briefly address one of appellate's contentions, and that is that, appellee's contentions, that appellant is barred from arguing this point on appeal. As set forth in appellant's opening brief, a court lacks authority and therefore jurisdiction to enter judgment for failure to comply with Rule 25 if there has not been personal service upon the decedent's successors or personal representative. Under well-settled law, jurisdictional defects can be raised at any time. An appellant would like to reserve the remainder of her time for rebuttal.
3 minutes and 17 seconds.
Good morning, Your Honor. Can you please report? I am Steve Mullen of the law firm of Rutherford, Mullen & Moore in Colorado Springs. My attorney registration number is 5082. I should just let the court know that until yesterday, my partner was counsel of record in this case. She broke her hip over the weekend in a skiing accident, so I'm picking this case up sort of at the last minute. But I think I understand the issues and give really a rather brief argument. It is suggested on behalf of the appellant that really the critical time here is when the plaintiff, appellant in this court, terminated her attorney-client relationship with her previous attorney, Mr. Hoffman. And carrying appellant's argument out to its logical conclusion, that would suggest that any time a client tells their attorney that they're unsatisfied with that attorney's representation or that the relationship is over, then according to that argument, all things cease. The attorney who is representing that client cannot act for that client, arguably cannot accept service or receive pleadings or orders. Really, the client, if that argument is carried to that conclusion, can just stop the wheels turning on the case until the client either puts the attorney back in charge or finds a new attorney, which happened in this case, but not until February of 2009. So if that argument holds water, that would mean that when the suggestion of death pursuant to Rule 25 was filed in this case in December of 2008, because the client had unilaterally said, I don't no longer want Mr. Hoffman to be my attorney, nothing can happen. If that argument holds water, then the client just stops everything. Arguably, if a court entered an order, Mr. Hoffman was no longer counsel to do anything about that order other than to pass it on to his client. And theoretically, he had a duty to pass on the suggestion of death in this case to the client. And the client or Mr. Hoffman then had to take some action within that 90-day period of time. But they can't just argue that no action was required because this relationship, attorney-client relationship, had been interrupted.
Aren't they just arguing improper service? If there's no attorney, then it has to be on the client, on the plaintiff.
And I think that is their argument.
And the rule would not allow nothing to happen. The rule at that point would say, you've got 90 days to get somebody else on board for the defendant. You got to keep things moving. Isn't that the whole reason, this rule?
And I agree, and I believe that point supports the appellee's position in this case.
Provided their service.
Correct.
That is a condition proceeding under the rule.
And we would argue, Judge, that service was appropriate on counsel of record pursuant to Rule 121, because as far as counsel for the defendant in the trial court, appellee here is concerned, the only person or entity upon whom service can be made until a formal order allowing withdrawal has been entered is upon counsel of record.
Mr. Mueller, Rule 121 does not address service of process, does it?
No, but I think if it's read in conjunction with Rule 5, Your Honor, it does. And that is that until an attorney is allowed by the trial court to withdraw and an order is entered to that effect, then service is proper upon that attorney. And I think actually Pearson supports that argument as well. Because as you noted, Pearson speaks to the fact that the court is going to be interested in who is the attorney of record. And that is whose service was made upon in this case. I think it's also important, Judge Furman, to consider the fact that from December 5 of 2008 until March 5, I believe, of 2009, the plaintiff and her counsel, whoever that was at the time, could have taken some action. If there was an interruption in counsel, that is, if plaintiff was seeking other counsel or whatever was going on over that 90-day period of time, she or one of the attorneys representing her could have asked for an extension of time.
But if there was no attorney?
Well, there was.
She had fired Mr. Hoffman, who was the attorney at that point.
And our argument, our position, Judge, would be that until the order entered on February 10 of 2009, granting Mr. Hoffman the ability to withdraw or be substituted for, he was the attorney of record. The motion for substitution of counsel on its face speaks to the fact that the plaintiff was represented until that point in time, that being when the motion to substitute counsel was made on February 6, 2009, and that new counsel was coming on board as of the date that the court allowed the substitution, which was February 10. So our argument is, Your Honor, if a new attorney was coming onto the case at that point in time and needed additional time, the Garcia case clearly allows for an enlargement of the time within which to deal with the suggestion of death or to make any other motion for relief at that time to grant a longer period of time to react. And as the court has noted this morning, the motion to dismiss was not filed until May 8th of 2009. Clearly, an even larger window of time for plaintiff or one of her attorneys to react, ask for additional time, or file a substitution of parties.
Go ahead.
Mr. Mullen, with regard to the Thompson case, it seems that the essence of that case is the authority granted to the attorney by the client, and what is the extent of that authority. And also, it would seem to me necessarily, the question is, as to the opposing party, what is their knowledge of the lawyer's authority? Why isn't that dispositive here?
Well, Your Honor, I appreciate the significance of the Thompson case. And our position is that with Rule 121, and I think the rationale of the Pearson case, the Thompson case is essentially no longer really applicable to this situation. And that being that under 121, until an attorney is granted leave to withdraw, that attorney remains counsel of record and is the entity upon whom service should be made. And that goes back to my original argument that otherwise a party could simply announce, I'm upset with my attorney and I'm firing my attorney, but then do nothing about it. Neither file a motion to withdraw or have a motion to withdraw be filed, nor substitute counsel. And in that way, a party could arguably take control of the timing of the case.
I assume that a competent defense counsel would address that before the court.
We would hope so.
Yes.
Yes.
My concern here, and I understand what you're saying about the Thompson case, my concern here is it a situation in which the client has the unfettered authority to simply say, this lawyer no longer represents me, or do they need the permission of the court for that to happen?
Well, for our purposes today, I would argue that the client does need, the client and her attorney need the permission of the court to allow the attorney no longer to be the representative for purposes of service, reaction to orders, that sort of thing. Yes.
Mr. Mueller, here's my question on this point, is what you're saying is Rule 121 would require permission of the court. But in the Thompson case, we actually have a trial court issuing an order saying, attorney, you must remain attorney of record. I don't care that your client fired you. And the Supreme Court said the court cannot do that. The court cannot create a relationship beyond what the client had desired. So how is Rule 121 any different from the situation in Thompson?
Well, we would argue, Your Honor, that effectively Rule 121 supersedes the Thompson case and makes clear on its face that an attorney is representing a client until that attorney has either allowed for a substitution of counsel or has filed a motion to withdraw and has been permitted by order to withdraw. So I understand your question, and I understand the Thompson case, but we feel that in the interest of judicial economy and for litigants and their attorneys to know who really is responsible here, until a party's attorney either substitutes counsel or is allowed to withdraw, they remain counsel on the case. That is our position. And otherwise, Your Honor, we would argue that then the attorney representing the other party, the defendant in this case, is between a rock and a hard place. And granted, we all should be creative with that and do something to try and get the issue straightened out. But should that really be the appellee's responsibility under these circumstances? That is it the appellee's responsibility to require the plaintiff to get counsel? Or to have that counsel, once substituted, do something to enlarge the times that are then running? That should not be the moving party or the appellee's responsibility in circumstances like this.
Well, if an appellee actually knows that the client is no longer represented by the attorney, does the appellee have any response, or in this case, the defendant, have any responsibility to serve or ask the court for permission to serve on the party instead of the party's former attorney?
I agree, Judge, that could happen. Yes, I agree that would be a good way to handle it. But in terms of having a responsibility, we would take the position that the appellee in this case doesn't have that responsibility. The appellee has the right to rely upon the fact that counsel is still there. I think, just to play devil's advocate with your argument, doesn't the plaintiff have the ultimate responsibility under these circumstances within a reasonable period of time to take some action. Substitute, fire her attorney, and have that attorney withdraw. That's where the responsibility for this case really lies. In this case, more or less just remained dormant between the time the plaintiff announced through her then attorney, Mr. Hoffman, that she was no longer satisfied with his representation in October, I believe, of 2008, until February of 2009, when some action was taken to substitute counsel at that point.
But at the point, I'm sorry, at the point that the notice of death was served, counsel knew that the client, the plaintiff, had fired Mr. Hoffman.
I agree that there had been a representation of that fact.
Well, that's pretty clear. I mean, regardless of the court entering an order substituting, at that point, wouldn't the easiest thing have been to simply serve the plaintiff directly?
I won't dispute that that could have been done.
Well, and if that was done, we wouldn't even be here on this issue.
Potentially, that's true.
Because that would have triggered the 90 days. You would agree?
I agree with that, yes. But I would then fall back on my previous argument that the responsibility really ought to be with the plaintiff to do something under those circumstances, rather than just leaving the case hanging.
But if this is a straight service, who do you serve properly? If you have information that Mr. Hoffman was fired, just serve client, and that would satisfy the rule 5.
I think that is true, Your Honor, except for the fact that we, as attorneys for litigants, are duty-bound to serve the attorney of record. And I suppose, yes, creatively, we could have served the plaintiff as well. I don't dispute that. Thank you very much for your consideration and your time this morning.
All right, Mr. Dean, you have 3 minutes and 17 seconds.
Thank you. Following up on the most recent discussion and to briefly rebut one of Appley's points, Appley's hypothetical conundrum of dormancy is illusory here. The plaintiff could have been personally served. Indeed, under Rule 25, which requires service in conformity with Rule 5, if you look at Rule 5, Rule 5 requires that service shall be made upon a party, or if the party is represented by an attorney, upon that attorney. The rule says if a party is represented by an attorney, not if a party has an attorney of record. And here it is undisputed that the appellant was no longer represented by an attorney. Thus, under Rule 5, which is referenced by Rule 25, service should have been made upon the plaintiff directly. What also has to be remembered is that the trial court based its dismissal of plaintiff's claims upon Rule 121 having the effect of continuing the attorney-client relationship irrespective of any decision by the client. This would constitute a stark departure from valid and existing Colorado case law, Thompson, Phillips, Berry, Olson, as well as decisions in other jurisdictions addressing this very issue, Smith, Lockhart, and Flint. A client has the absolute right to discharge counsel at any time and for any reason. That absolute right is rendered meaningless absent the recognition by the courts of this state that the client cannot thereafter be bound by the acts of that discharged attorney or be subject to service of process through the previously discharged attorney.
Mr. Dean, we have to have an orderly administration of the process, and it's one thing for the client to tell the lawyer to leave and you're no longer representing me, and it's another thing for the court system to be bound by that without knowledge. Now, I understand in this case we had some notice to the defendant, but the court system at that point has no knowledge of the circumstances. Can't we have court rules that say, all right, here's the way it works? If you want to change counsel, here's what you do. If you're dismissing counsel and you're proceeding pro se, here's what you do. And until you do that, then, you know, maybe you can stop the client, the attorney, from taking positive actions to bind you. They can't sign the settlement. They can't do various things to bind you. But why can't the court say, till you tell us, that's where the mail's going?
And I believe that such rules could be instituted. The rule that we are discussing, Rule 121, does not concern itself with the termination of the attorney-client relationship. It is concerned with the duties of the attorney as opposed to the client.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.